RadioInfluence.com.
We are back for another edition of the MMA Report podcast. I am Jason Floyd. He is Daniel Galvan. This is the Christmas Eve edition of the podcast as I was out of town for a couple of days, back in town. And, well, Daniel, there is a ton to talk about here on this edition of the podcast. We'll talk about what happened last weekend. UFC Vegas number 17, which part of that story is a fact of, well, it's the last time we're going to see Anthony Pettis in the UFC octagon as he is now a PFL fighter. We are going to rank the first three main events of the year for the UFC in 2021. We'll talk about who was the bigger breakout fighter in 2020. Was it Kevin Holland or was it Khamzat Chimaev? But Daniel, we got to talk about this video. The victory lap, I guess you would say, by Dana White, or maybe we just put it more of a propaganda video put out by the UFC this week.
Yeah, you sent it to me. I wasn't able to watch it because I was at work at the time, but after I got out of work for my lunch break, I watched it, and it was absolutely straight up Dana White. Like, it's to be expected from Dana White, right? He lives in his own bubble. It's really the only bubble the UFC has, which is kind of crazy in the middle of a pandemic, but I digress. But the propaganda video was, it was like a parody of what you would envision Dana White would do. So yeah, I think ironically enough, even though this week is bookended by a pretty interesting fight night event with some intriguing results that are in the rear view mirror, and in the front view mirror, we have all these dope fight announcements that we're going to dig into and dissect, but it's pretty fitting of where the UFC is in 2020 that the biggest storyline this week is some stupid thing Dana White did. And so that, if anything else, when you look at this video and all the takeaways, my biggest takeaway is Dana White's number one goal is to make Dana White a star and not the other fighters, and that is going to affect the bottom line. And so, yeah, there were so many inaccuracies in that video. It was a pretty awful video. But unfortunately, the worst part is there is a huge group of people that this video plays to, and it kind of serves to brainwash. And that's probably the most unfortunate thing out of anything, is that this video works and people believe the BS that's in it.
To me, this is Dana White taking a play out of the Donald Trump playbook, where, you know, Donald Trump has a very loyal fan base. And Dana White understands he has a very loyal fan base. I mean, look, I think you don't see Adam Silver taking a victory lap for what the NBA did, who, by the way, you got to commend the NBA for what they did with their bubble. And of course, you know, I want to talk about some of the comments that I saw from people in the MMA media industry. But, you know, but when I saw this video, I watched it. And so I was like, you know what? I want to know what the fans of MMA have to say. And so here's some of the comments that I got. This was at George1 UFC fan. He goes, "That was a pretty good promo. I, for one, am glad they pulled it off, but was skeptical at first. Don't know what I would have done without the UFC putting on weekly shows." Then Hunter Man says, "There are two levels to MMA media ignorance, motives, and Dana addresses only the first. The second level, as with Russia intelligence, a Trump scam, for example, is far more dangerous, and it's the roots are criminals." Omar says, "There's got to be a cheaper ways to blow Dana." Jimmy Burke says, "He's a businessman. I love the UFC, and I believe what he has done has taken it to the next level. Nobody can fault him for what he's accomplished. I know it's kept me sane in this rough time." Jim says, it says zero jobs lost, but they are cutting their roster significantly heading into 2021. Carl says, "Dana going full propaganda on this one." Will says, "Absolutely love it. As a UFC fan, I am a fan of the fighters. Dana White is a fighter. Media was so badly rooting against him the whole time. Who's on top now?" Jason says, "Sad." Then Matt says, responded to that. He goes, "What's sad, the video or what Dana did?" First off, you know, Dana likes to rail on the media when they do clickbait. First off, this is clickbait. This is exactly what they did. I want to say kudos to Jedi Goodman on Twitter. There was a piece of this video where I'm not sure if it was Ariel Helwani on a show he did on ESPN, or maybe it was just maybe he was appearance on the show, where literally it was about this 40-second clip of Ariel talking about it, and they took 2 seconds and completely took what Ariel said out of context. Now, I do want to mention what some of my fellow MMA media people did mention. Sean Sheehan had 2 great tweets on this from severemma.com. He says, "Props to the MMA media who help people to account in a tough situation, despite the criticism from all sides and the negatives it might have for yourself. That's the job. Not all did, so credit to those who did it when they knew what was coming." He also had this tweet where he's basically, this is his made up transcript. "Dana, we're carrying on no matter what. Media, you need to do it safely. Dana, shut up, you pussy, goof, Tachi Palace. Dana's boss, no. Media, get some protocols, test, and keep people safe. UFC, okay, we've got safe protocols and testing. Media, thumbs up. Dana, we proved you pussies wrong." Which I was just straight up laughing when I saw that one. This was a comment from Ben Foulkes in relation to the video that Jedi put out there, where the UFC selectively used portion of an Ariel Helwani quote. He goes, "Surely there must be some logical explanation for this. Who but the scumbag media would intentionally edit a quote like this in order to purposely take it out of context?" And this was, Simon Samana, who is a editor over MMA Junkie. He was quoting a tweet from Luke Thomas, who Luke did a great job of tracking down every article that was cited in this video the UFC put out there. Simon said, "Because UFC stood out as one of the sports leagues that refused to shut down in March, April, legit questions about public safety were asked. When no answers were given, the questions continue. That led to this ridiculous narrative that media rooted against the UFC during the pandemic." I can tell you my personal experience with the UFC on this one was when they were trying to do that show in Tachi Palace. I had gotten a quote from a portion of the ABC, and they had said, we're not condoning this. You know, you're basically electing to go on a tribal land when the California State Athletic Commission has said, we're not going to regulate this event, and you're still going to go ahead and you're going to self-regulate this event like it's an international event. And I think my biggest part of this, Daniel, is the fact of the UFC, they told this story the way they wanted to tell the story. They left out a lot of the facts that a lot of those articles that they noted were actually articles that were talking about when they were trying to do the event at Tachi Palace.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's very ironic because when you look at this video, all of the criticism and the general tone and things Dana says in this video or prior to it when it comes to his feedback towards the media pertains to him. This video is quote unquote fake news. The majority of the criticism in this video that was said during the time period when they were trying to run in Taichi. Somehow, in this 4-minute video, we had all these sound bites, but we didn't get the sound bite from his boss, Bob Iger, or whoever it was, telling him, hey, do not run this show. That was really embarrassing. And it was embarrassing because Dana White did not take the pandemic seriously, and he was trying to put on an event at a time when we, as a sports community, didn't know how to put on events. So, the fact that this video doesn't include that major event, especially because that's when so much of the criticism was surrounding it. This is literally a fake video, right? Whenever UFC was doing the Fight Island events, by and large, the MMA community and media applauded the UFC. They did. The lambasting did not take place during that time period. This video is very literally propaganda. And it's insane, and it's insane, but it makes sense, and it's logical because it's in the UFC's best interest to, it's in the UFC's best interest to, in the eye of the fan, belittle the media. Because in general, good journalism is pretty damn simple. And it's rare, but it's pretty damn simple. Good journalism is shining the light where people don't want it to be shined, so you inform the masses about what's going on, right? Public relations is what the UFC wants the media to be. Maybe if I get on Dana's good side, I'll say he's the greatest thing since sliced bread and he's got the greatest hair of all time. But I'm not in the business to wash his back and scratch his butt. I'm here just to say what I'm seeing and be accurate. And that's what journalism is. And in terms of good journalism, it is finding things out, shining a light like people like John Nash do. And then another part of the media is just observing what's happening and giving your analysis and having a good time with the sport that you do love. Like, we as a media in general come in with the implicit bias that we do love this sport. But it's not fun to pretend like we're from North Korea and to blindly praise the UFC. That's so lame and boring. But Dana doesn't want to hear that. He doesn't want to be held accountable. He just wants to be a part of some type of cult. So it's in the UFC's best interest, at least in their mind at this point, when you watch this video, that they control the media. But that won't ever happen because there's enough people with working brains that won't let that happen with enough common sense. And so overall, I mean, this video was pretty awful. I hated it, and it's crazy because, honestly, I think while the UFC did a lot of great things when it comes to putting on sporting events and giving people a distraction, in the grand scheme of this once-in-a-lifetime pandemic where everybody listening to this made sacrifices, myself, yourself, and everyone listening, we all had to be selfless and make sacrifices to try and stop the spread, I would say Dana White was a negative when it comes to the pandemic. This is a guy who, I mean, there's 326,000 people in America who died from coronavirus, Jason. This is a guy who has a clear audience, and he could have communicated to them to, I don't know, wear a mask. But how often did we see Dana wear a mask?
That is the point I was going to bring up, Daniel. When have we seen, someone please show me photo evidence that Dana White has worn a mask? And I think that is part of, like, as I look at just kind of this whole aspect of it, I mean, look, you know, I wrote down, to me, I think there are four media members that Dana White likes. I think everyone else said that he looks at the enemy of the UFC. And it's not hard to figure out who those four MMA media members are that, you know, is kind of, they're in the Dana White inner circle. And look, if you're in the inner circle, great for you. But the fact is that, you know, Dana White, and this is no different than any other promoter. They look at the media as an extension of their PR department. And if you say something that they view as negative, that, you know, you become the enemy of the people. And I'll tell you, I remember getting a phone call from the UFC when they did not like the, you know, the quote that I put out there. Basically my response was like, I'm not the person to be mad at. Be mad at the people who gave me the quote.
Yeah. Right. But that's not how things work. So often, big corporations and companies like to bully journalists. It's what they do. And journalism, again, in 2020 is much worse than it was. Well, that's unfair. So there's a lot of journalism and there's a lot of good journalism. But I really strongly feel like when I watch stuff today versus like a 60 minutes interview in 1980, I feel like people were more held accountable. It's a hard thing to say because people are held accountable now, but it just felt like the questions and the way interviews went, the interview subject was more like held their feet to the fire. Whereas now it's kind of a buddy-buddy system where it's like, if I'm nice to you, you'll give me more access. Whereas in the 80s and in the 90s, it felt like that access was a given for the media so they could ask tougher questions, right? It's kind of a funny example, but you see it where Charles Barkley and Kenny Smith and Shaq don't care whenever they're interviewing Kevin Durant or Paul George on night one of the NBA. And I mean, that type of interview is what intrigues me. But yeah, you will see that where those people will try and bully the media. And at some points they'll be successful. A couple things. One, we have been talking about it like it is just the media. And I do hate doing that. I hate grouping everyone into a singular group. And I think that's unfair because there's great journalists. There's poor journalists. There's people who are in between. There's people who don't aspire to be journalists and whatnot. And there are major differences. But whenever we stereotype people into one large group, that's when we live and delve into falsehoods. You wish the UFC would be professional, like leagues that actually maybe should be commended, like the NBA or the NHL or the WNBA. Those leagues did well, but they are respectable and professional, and you won't see a propaganda-type video like that out there. So the UFC is kind of out on an island, which is ironic because of Fight Island, but this is not something you would see any other sports league do because it's asinine and it's tone-deaf. Whenever we should be really the only groups of people we should be applauding in this awful, wretched thing would be healthcare workers, people who develop the vaccine, people who are delivering the vaccine. I was editing a news story the other day. I saw this beautiful story where this UPS driver who lost his dad to COVID was the one delivering the vaccine. Stories like that are so sad, but it's empowering. And those are the people we should applaud. But I really feel like the UFC as a whole, the general message they were sending out to the public was a negative message when it comes to helping us beat this pandemic. And so that's why it bugs me the most, to be honest with you. I really believe they were sending a general message that was negative. And I think that's important because when we were dealing with a worldwide pandemic in 2020, Jason, one of the biggest issues we as a country had was the general public trusting the information that they were being given. Had the general public actually listened, and all of us did, had we all been on the same page, I strongly believe there would be a lot less people dead today than there is. But that's not the case. We live in a very polarized, divided country where people don't believe basic stuff. And I really believe, as a whole, the UFC, specifically Dana White, was not a positive when it comes to that. And that, to me, is the only measure I am looking at when it comes to applauding people as it regards the COVID-19 outbreak. For the UFC, it was a no-brainer for them to put on events because they needed to fulfill their obligations of the ESPN deal so Dana White could line his pockets. And while he's lining his pockets, he can also cut fighters who have experience in the UFC so he can pay fighters that of far less rate who are coming in through the Contender Series.
You know, I think, and you mentioned this point a little earlier, and I think it's a big point of this of, you know, I mean, look, this is UFC doing what the UFC does, but instead of having your video editors put this video together, because, I mean, Daniel, this is what you do for a living. You put this stuff together. It's not like they spent like 10 minutes putting this together. This was probably hours upon hours of getting all this stuff together. Is instead of doing that video, how about you just do a video highlighting all the great action we saw in 2020?
Yeah. I mean, when you look at this 4-minute video, how much of stuff inside the cage did we see? And the thing is, even within the framework of this video, let's say they kept the same topic, right? But they decide, because here's the thing, real quick. Okay, this topic is interesting. It's controversial, and it will get a whole crap load of views. And I haven't seen the latest view count, but I know it's a lot. So if this same production team did a best of 2020 video, it would have gotten far less views. So the cynical part of me thinks, what if we kept the same topic, but inside we spliced videos of some of these great fights that happened and we make it clear who these fighters are so that the people, the millions of people watching this video also consume this content and identify with these fighters and they know who they are and they'll be sure to watch them in 2021. That is an outright failure as a promoter and it shows you again where the priorities are. That the people that Dana White put over were Brian Campbell, were Ariel Helwani, were Josh Gross and Bob Arum. Not Chimaev, not Kevin Holland, not Gilbert Burns. It was the MMA media who gained popularity, not the UFC fighters. And that is a clear problem. What's wrong in 2020 when it comes to the UFC is the star power lessening with the top level UFC fighters.
You know, there was some media people going, damn it, why could you put my name in that video? By the way, so I just looked it up, the Twitter video, 2.3 million views.
Yeah, by the way, there's no one thing that stuck with me, and I don't know the specific quote, I should have wrote it down, but I'm pretty sure they said in that video that it was the highest pay-per-view buy rate average during that time period, which that to me seems like malarkey. I mean, maybe it was ballooned up because there were so few events and you had a couple big ones, but I don't believe that's true. because there were some lame duck pay-per-view shows, and the numbers in general are a little bit tad bit lower for non-primetime events. So I saw that. I was like, that's a bunch of malarkey.
Yeah, I don't know about that. The one thing I did find very interesting, I don't know if you saw this. So Conor McGregor put out this image the other day where he saw about, you know, showed the figures of how much his pay-per-view in January sold for, which my first thought was, ooh, Conor McGregor audited those numbers. So it makes me wonder, did Conor maybe not believe what the UFC told him?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Look, for Conor, I would think so. I mean, for him in that position, it's all about dotting your I's and crossing your T's and seeing the things for reals. So, yeah, I mean, Conor's one of the few fighters in the world that are on an even playing field when it comes to negotiating with the UFC.
You got to have leverage on the UFC in these contract negotiations, and he's the only guy that really does, because look, you know, anytime Conor McGregor fights, he's going to bring intrigue to the sport. And I mean, look, I think overall, when you talk about the popularity of mixed martial arts, it's grown a ton in 2020. And look, I'll be the first one to tell you, I mean, this is probably my most profitable year in terms of what I do in terms of MMA. Full disclosure. I mean, you know, and our thoughts was, you know, hey, can you do this thing safely? And one of the things that I think you do find interesting, and you heard about 2 weeks ago, and then you heard it last week with the fighters talking about how the COVID protocols had changed in Vegas. It was like, well, no crap. These protocols were clearly too lax. You saw the amount of COVID positive tests that were going out there. And it's unfortunate, Daniel, you mentioned this. It's like, you know, the biggest news story in MMA is a propaganda, clickbait, taken out of context video by the UFC instead of a great night of fights last Saturday night, where you look at, you know, Stephen Thompson goes out there, puts on a solid performance, getting a 5-0 win over Jeff Neal. Rob Font returns for the first time in over a year, knocks out Marlon Moraes. Jose Aldo, you know, still, you know, showing he is a contender at 135 pounds. Like, that should be what should be the biggest topic in the sport. But unfortunately, Dana made the story about him and not about the fighters.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the one thing we're seeing is fighters not re-signing the promotion, like Anthony Pettis, or fighters get released like Yoel Romero. But I do think when you look across the MMA landscape and you're looking at which web articles are getting the most hits, I would assume this week it's all the articles that deal with this particular video. So I guess my advice going forward is, look, if you're the UFC, look at what happened in this video in terms of how it garnered attention, and try and extrapolate that to your fighters, because that's where the money is made, right? Like Thompson is one of the top welterweights in the world, and he showed that against Jeff Neal. But how many people were aware of what transpired in that main event? You know, how many people were aware that Rob Font certified himself as a bantamweight contender? I mean, he's going to get a fight maybe with TJ Dillashaw at this point with that impressive win over Marlon Moraes. I'm not sure too many people are, but they are aware about this video. And so while I think our criticism of Dana and this video is something that you will see from most MMA media members, very similar tone and analysis, it is worth understanding that we are in our MMA media bubble. And unfortunately, if we expand out, I really think this video did resonate with quite a few people. And they are drinking the bathwater of Dana White. You know, one of my favorite podcasts in the whole world is Part of My Take. And they talked about this, but it wasn't in a Dana stupid. It was just in a general positive light. And that's one of the top sports podcasts in the world. It was a minor moment when they talked about this video. And so I think the casual sports fan probably sees this, and probably, depending on their political leaning, you'll know what their analysis of this video is, right? So we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that even though we can identify that this video is full of fecal matter from that of a bovine, there's a whole lot of people who are down with the chicken salad that Dana White is cooking that is comprised totally of chicken shit.
I want to mention this one point before we move on to what happened last Saturday night. There's also a major difference between the UFC versus the NFL, the NBA, MLB, and the NHL. All those sports leagues have to negotiate a deal with the Players Association. The UFC doesn't. They can make whatever rules they want and basically tell the fighters, take it or leave it. That is the major difference on why the UFC was able to return so quickly, as opposed to part of the reason the other sports leagues took their time.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly true. This is more of a traveling circus, and it's easier to pick up the circus and plop it down wherever you want, unless the governor don't like it. One last thought for me is this. Let's not pretend people entering this bubble, the fight cards, didn't get COVID. Several fighters got COVID-19 throughout this process, as expected. And so the things that we don't know is how many people who had COVID-19 that were attending these events spread the virus to other people. We don't know that, and we never will. Contact tracing is incredibly hard. So, I mean, that's a relevant question to have, in that there is a real moral exchange we make in order to have our sports. And our sports are great, and they provide us with so much joy. And it's so awesome to watch the UFC, every week. But let us not get lost in the fact that there is a very real pandemic going on, and the virus is spreading, and we don't know how the virus has spread. That's just something we will never know when it comes to the fact that we are having a different fight card every single week with a different group of fighters and a different group of cornermen flying in airports, flying to the fight, and flying out.
Yeah, I saw someone else basically bring up that point as well of, you know what happened when someone who was at an MMA event, was there potentially, did they maybe contract it and give it to somebody else? I mean, that's something that we just don't know. But it's just, I just wish that the UFC would have put the spotlight on the fighters as opposed to put the spotlight on Dana White and building up his ego there. But, mentioned by UFC Vegas 17, one fighter I didn't mention earlier, and I've been thinking about this now for a couple of days, is we saw Greg Hardy go out there and lose to Marcin Tybura, and after the fight was over, and essentially kind of the way the fight ended, where Greg Hardy, the fight hits the mat, and he looks like he just is absolutely clueless on what to do. And I remember as that fight concluded, I was like, if you're the UFC, is it just time to get out of the Greg Hardy business?
Man, look, for me, I would say hell yeah, right? You know me, I'm not a Greg Hardy fan, Jason. I wouldn't be doing business with Greg Hardy. Here's the thing, though. He looked great in round one. He looked really good against a tough heavyweight. Marcin Tybura is damn good. And Greg Hardy clearly won round one. Now, two things happened. One, he got put on his back. Two, time elapsed. I don't know if Greg Hardy has the ability to get a good condition, right? Like, literally, like, physically. Like, I don't know if it's physically possible for him to... Well, he has good conditioning, right? Anyone who competes in the UFC probably has good conditioning. But as a heavyweight, to not get gassed in round two and three, you have to have elite-level conditioning. And sometimes it's just physically hard. Clearly, Greg Hardy trains, but this dude is just out of energy in round two. So between the lack of energy and between the lack of ground game, Greg Hardy's not going to have a whole lot of success in the UFC heavyweight division when he goes up against top 15 heavyweights. But on the pro side, he round one in this fight against Tybura, I will say this, that was one of the most impressive frames of Greg Hardy's career. The unfortunate thing for Hardy is that round is followed up by one of the least impressive frames he's had thus far as a UFC heavyweight.
It's just one of those things, man. That fight hit the ground and he just, look, how much of that was simply he had, the gas tank was, beyond E, but it just looked like he was a guy that, like, I sat there, like, my mindset was like, does this guy ever work off his back in training?
Yeah, I mean, I would assume so, Jason. But, I would assume he's going and doing his training on the ground and putting himself in positions that aren't great. But clearly, he's not going to win Abu Dhabi anytime soon. I think long term, when you're looking at Greg Hardy, he's really good with his striking. And maybe for him, when it comes to making a lot of money in the combat sports business, it's doing like a bare knuckle boxing. That might be his long-term outlook, because as a grappler, the skills aren't there, and he may have more successes if he just purely continues to upgrade his cardio to go with this takedown defense, because he's able to keep the fights on the feet. He's going to be quite successful, which is an accomplishment in its own when you look at how late he transitioned to this sport. But the grappling skill is at a below average level. I mean, it's kind of similar to Chase Hooper striking. The difference is Hardy's cardio impacts the takedown defense, and it impacts his ability to prevent fights from going to where he just has 0% chance of winning. And that's why, again, for Greg, he does continue to improve, and there is upside there, but there is a ceiling, and the ceiling is against a top 10 heavyweight, a top 15 caliber guy.
I mean, look, I think, you know, if you sit there and say the story of UFC Vegas 17 is the phenomenal main event that we saw, just, you know, two guys going to battle. But I will say this. I think my biggest storyline out of UFC Vegas 17 is Rob Font.
Yeah, I think the biggest storyline were those two bantamweight performances out of Font and Aldo, right? Thompson clearly, against Jeff Neal, set himself apart. Like, even though he's nearing 40 years old, it's clear that he still has a real possibility of challenging for the welterweight championship. The skill level is just really high, and he's maintained it, right? Jose Aldo at bantamweight, showcased in round one, his stand-up is still pretty darn stellar. And in round three, it's a reminder that he's a high-level grappling expert. So Aldo maintained himself. But in terms of the number one star, it would be Rob Font. And I think it's the way he beat Marlon Moraes. With Aldo and Thompson, they got those decision wins. Aldo won 2 out of 3 rounds. Thompson swept the fight in each round. Well, one of the rounds was pretty close in the midpoint of the fight. But for Rob Font, it was a clear, decisive victory. It was a striking win over one of the top strikers in this sport. And that's why Rob Font really stamped himself as the top star of Fight Night. And I do think out of anyone, when you look at who improved their stock the most, who rose the most, it's Rob Font. He's faced a lot of adversity when it comes to, there's been times when he's been put in this position and he's lost. And also, there's been times when he's been on the shelf for a long time. Well, now with this win over Marlon Moraes, I think Rob Font finds himself in the best position of his entire career. And I think when you look at his frame and his ability with his hands, I think there's a real likelihood that if he gets past, you know, I mean, he's one fight away, basically, from challenging for the title. And I think a Font versus Dillashaw fight would be so damn exciting and would be something I would absolutely sit down and watch. I think that's a fight that you can absolutely headline an event with.
I will tell you, so on Sunday's podcast, I will be joined by Tyson Shardy. I actually recorded the interview last night. And, you know, two things I'll tell you that came out of that interview was, you know, Tyson said that right before the fight started, as they were getting ready to make the walk, that his mindset, he thought that Marlon was going to go the grappling route. He did not think that Marlon was going to stand with them, and mentioned to me that is something that they had worked on all camp long, because they thought there was a really good chance that Marlon would try to take it to the ground. Now, after the fights were over, I say Rob Font versus Jose Aldo. And then, of course, you know, Rob, you know, joins the list of fighters who have said that they're interested in taking on TJ Dillashaw. And I asked Tyson about that. I said, you know, has there been any dialogue with the UFC about that? And he said, you know, this time there hasn't. He goes, you know, we're kind of in a wait and see type mentality. But one thing that he did mention to me is that, of course, Calvin Kattar's fighting Max Holloway in the first main event of the year on Fight Island on January 16th. Their charter plane leaving Fight Island does not leave till January 21st. There's a January 20th event. Rob Font will be in the corner of Calvin Kattar. And Pedro Munhoz just happens to be on that January 20th card. And Tyson noted me, says, you know what, if Pedro's opponent doesn't make it the fight night, we'll be ready to take that fight.
Well, that's a great, great move for his group of guys to be primed in a position to take another fight. I mean, when we look at the fighters in 2020 who had their biggest years, it was fighters who were in a position to fill in on late notice and they made their names. So, I mean, Rob Font has already established himself, but certainly to get another top five fight in a short period of time, I mean, that's a great spot for him to be in. So I think for him, it's all about recovery, and I'm sure there isn't a lot of recovery in a fight like that against Moraes. But this sport is very funny because there are ebbs and flows. There are times when you're on the shelf for a long time and it feels like forever. But also, things can happen in an instant, whether it be getting knocked out or knocking people out on your way to superstardom. And for Rob Font, the win over Marlon Moraes sets things up quite nicely. And for Marlon, you feel for him because I saw this on Twitter somewhere and I wish I could credit to whoever it was, but I just saw it. But like, I don't know if there's been a more, this is such an impressive guy who's come off like 3 out of 4 losses. And in his last 4 fights, 3 of them were losses, right? Like, he's a really talented dude who's coming out back-to-back losses, is Marlon Moraes. I mean, to lose Hudo Sanhagen, Font, and a Sun Sal, and those are your only losses in the UFC, that's quite impressive. So, I mean, from the get-go, Moraes has fought nothing but monsters. And, you know, even though his losses are very highlight reel worthy with the way he's been finished, don't sleep on Marlon. He's just been thrown to the fire against some of the toughest bantamweights in the UFC.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Marlon, and I saw James Lynch had posted a clip from his conversation with Corey Sanhagen earlier this week where Corey basically said, he's like, hey, I think Marlon came back too quickly. And I think there is definitely something to that. But overall, it was a great night to end the year in terms of the UFC. Of course, we do have a Ryzen event coming up, so we still got another MMA event coming up this year. But, you know, Anthony Pettis goes out there, gets a win, and it all happens really quickly where he goes on Twitter, announces that he's a free agent, and within hours, he is signed by the PFL. He's going to compete at lightweight. One of the interesting things that we'll mention about this, about PFL, and you mentioned about John Nash earlier in the show, great reporter in terms of MMA, and he had this tweet yesterday about the PFL. He said, quote, I have been told that PFL fighters have been informed that they have to be quarantined in Vegas 17 days before their fight. That means they'll have to be in the bubble over 35 straight days for 2 fights in the regular season. How are they not employees yet? And then he quotes this tweet. He says, it's one thing for a promoter to require a fighter to a city for a few days in advance of a fight. It's something completely different to require them to live somewhere for 6 straight weeks. So kind of something, a very interesting note on the PFL there in terms of clearly they're taking their bubble extremely serious for their season, which is going to start in April 2021. Now, Daniel, when Anthony Pettis announced he's a free agent, I was like, oh, foregone conclusion, he's going to Bellator. But you know what? Goes to the PFL, and you have to say this, it's probably the best decision for him.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's a lot of money on the line if you win a tournament here. You know, I mean, that's, for him, that's likely the biggest possible payday he could make going forward in this sport. And I think that when you look at the roster of guys, it's not unrealistic to say he could be one of the top favorites to win a lightweight tournament or a welterweight tournament, depending on what weight class he fights in. I mean, for the PFL, you know, damn, maybe one of the biggest fights you could do down the line is Anthony Pettis versus Rory McDonald. I mean, if you have both guys, you know, win their respective tournaments, you know, maybe that could be something you could do down the line, depending on which weight classes you have them fight. And I mean, I think Pettis would probably fight at welterweight, but I think this much, you know, we make fun and joke about the PFL. And it's easy to, especially with some of the stupid stuff they say. But I will say, they've made a lot of intriguing signings in this very long offseason. And you can color me interested with these fight cards. Logically, I don't understand the business model of this promotion. I don't understand where the profit is coming from. They're spending a whole lot of money. But simply put, I will be pretty damn interested in these, with these events. And there's been quite a few signings from PFL, whether it be Shields, McDonald, Pettis. Those, to me, are positive signings. And I'm quite excited to see some of these events with some of these fighters they've put together.
I think the PFL is doing some interesting things. If Pettis would have gone to Bellator, I think he'd be an underdog in potentially a lot of the fights that they would have booked him in. But I mean, look, he needs to be fighting at 155. He, you know, and there's potentially some interesting matchups there. I just think that ultimately, I think it was an excellent decision, you know, made by Anthony Pettis. And I think it's also like, I'm not surprised that, you know, I mean, clearly, because if the UFC wanted Anthony Pettis to be a member of their organization, they would have put a fight offer on the table, or a contract on the table that he could not refuse. And so, but I look from the UFC's aspect, I understand why you part ways with Anthony Pettis.
Well, why would you say that? Why do you see from the UFC's perspective for the reason being you would part with Anthony?
While he's a name, and while I don't see him as someone who's going to rise up the 155 pound rankings to be a top challenger, but he has the abilities to derail an up and coming contender.
Yeah, that's a valid point. I think from my point of view, I'm willing to take that risk, and I'm okay with taking that risk, because the guys who Anthony would derail, they would have found themselves derailed against another opponent anyway, right? But the thing is, I really feel like people like Pettis and Riol Romero, for example, are very valuable because they're fighters who people actually know. They aren't completely past their prime. They are past it, but they aren't tomato cans. But they're fighters who you as a promotion have invested in a way where you promoted them, and they are known commodities. And I just think there's great value, even though you're paying them more money than you are somebody coming off the Contender Series, to keep them on your fight cards, because people know who Anthony Pettis is. And he serves as a platform for the fighters who are successful against him to become that next generation of star. So the reason why I'd be hesitant to pull the plug, because the idea that he would stop guys from progressing or upset them, the two things I would say is, one, you know, a loss to Anthony Pettis isn't a death sentence. Guys can rehabilitate themselves. But secondly, those guys who are going to become superstars aren't going to lose to Anthony Pettis in 2021. So that those are the reasons why. But I just feel like the reason why this decision was made was financially. Anthony's probably just commanding a lot of money, and I'm sure he signed a nice fat check with the PFL, and that's why it makes the most sense in the world. But my own personal philosophy, if I was running a promotion, and I know I'm not, I would certainly value bringing in and keeping guys like Pettis and Romero. It's important to have these guys for the fans to remember who they are, and also for those fighters, because at some point, if you're a fighter signing a contract at the UFC, you know, you got to keep your eye behind you, because the UFC is going to take a shotgun and shoot you like your old Yeller, so they don't got to give you that paycheck.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, just win, baby. You win and people want to see you fight, the UFC is going to want to be in your business.
Anthony won.
I just think it comes to a point where I think, you know, and look, and it obviously there's a financial component to this. I mean, let's not kid ourselves, but it's just, I look at it and I say, is like, if you're in the UFC shoes, what do you view as the long-term Anthony Pettis business?
The long-term Anthony Pettis business is, you know, it is using him as a platform to create the next Anthony Pettis. Is what I would tell you, Jason.
Yeah, I just, you know, look, I'm not surprised. It was very clear Anthony Pettis was ready to move on. And overall, I mean, look, it's a good signing. It'll be interesting to see kind of whenever Anthony Pettis does fight for the PFL, what kind of television audience does he bring in to the ESPN product? But, you know, Daniel, 2021 is, you know, we're a week away from 2021 kicking off here. And the UFC announced this week their first three main events of the year for January 16th, January 20th, and January 23rd. Of course, that will be Holloway Cater, Edwards Chimaev, and Poirier McGregor. These are all three great fights. Apparently, it looks like Chandler Dan Hooker is going to be your co-main event of Dustin Poirier, Conor McGregor. Just take my money, UFC. I love that 1-2 punch combination. But and when I say rank these three main events, there's no wrong answer in this one. They're all three great ones. In terms of, you know, kind of, I guess it would be as your view of the sport. When I look 1-2-3, I don't know if we'll have the same number one.
I think we have the same number one, Jason.
What's your number one?
My number one is Chimaev Edwards.
No, that is not my number
one. Oh, damn. You have Holloway Cater, don't you?
Yeah, I have Holloway Cater. I love that fight. I think that's a great fight. You know, it came out reportedly that fight card is going to be on ABC, which I find really interesting in a couple of different ways. One way is because I just happened to look this up here yesterday. You do realize the NFL has a doubleheader that day on January. It'll be 4:30 and 8:30 game. So it makes me wonder if maybe they're going to do, you know, maybe a kind of like a Khabib start time of like 2:00 Eastern time. But I just think that's a great fight. I'll tell you how I ranked them. 1, Holloway Cater. 2, Poirier McGregor. 3, Edwards Chimaev.
Yeah, we're flipped. We are completely and totally flipped. Okay, these are 3 dope fights, bro. And like, these 3 fights make me smile and they make me happy, and I know we're going to miss 2 of them. I know 2 of them aren't going to happen. And damn, Hooker Chandler, dude. I'm hyped for 2021. I really am. But yeah, I got Chimaev Edwards number 1. The sole reason is, out of all 6 fighters, Chimaev is the one I'm most excited to see fight. If we're power ranking the list of who I'm most excited to see fight, Chimaev is 1 and Edwards might be 6, actually, which is unfortunate for Edwards, but these are all damn good fighters.
I agree with that.
But, you know, Leon just doesn't excite me, but I'm still, like, this fight is dope. And Edwards, I mean, it's been years since his name has been, Leon's name has been tied to so many damn fights during this pandemic, but he hasn't fought since he fought Dos Anjos. And it's going to be great to finally see him compete, right? Yeah. So I'm hyped for this fight, man. Poirier McGregor, I mean, a beautiful fight. It's going to be a great contest. And then Holloway Cater, in this same universe with just a couple different judges, Holloway Cater is a UFC featherweight championship fight. So all these fights are great main events, but when it comes to my rankings, we are flipped. I have Chimaev Edwards 1, Cater, Holloway 3, and of course we both have Poirier McGregor numero dos.
Yeah, I mean, look, there is no wrong answer. I mean, they're all 3 great fights. You mentioned about Chimaev, which leads me to this question: who is the bigger breakout fighter in 2020, Kevin Holland or Khamzat Chimaev?
Ooh, it's a beautiful question. I mean, Kevin Holland had quite a big year. Literally 5 wins in 2020. I mean, unbelievable out of Kevin Holland. Great wins too. I mean, you know, the win over Buckley, Hernandez, Stewart, Ontiveros, and Jacare to cap it off. But the reason why I say Chimaev, it's pretty damn simple. You know, Chimaev was a bigger breakout star because he is a guy who is just more popular than Kevin Holland. I think between these two, Chimaev is someone that more casual people know. Between these two, he's the guy who's more often floated around with a potential Conor fight, right? That's almost the measure of success on how popular you are. Are people talking about how you might fight Conor? Then you're pretty damn popular. And so Holland had a year for the record books. So did Chimaev. Because I feel like Chimaev resonated with people more, that's why I think he's the breakout fighter of the year. But Kevin Holland, all in all, the resume is more impressive when it comes to his 5 victories, I think.
The reason I would go with Chimaev here is more of, I think he has got a higher probability of becoming a UFC champion in the next 2 years.
I completely agree with you. I think between these two fighters, with the outright dominance of his performances, Chimaev represents that. I think from a pure resume standpoint, at the end of the day, we're looking at 3-0 versus 5-0. The year 2020 Kevin Holland had was superior than the year that Chimaev had. And to me, that's not debatable. When you look at the 2 extra wins, the win over Jacare. But when it comes to breakout, I don't think it's 100% all that. It's just who broke out. Who is going to be the guy? Chimaev represents that. He really does. And I think he's the breakout fighter.
Yeah, I mean, look, it is so fast. It's going to be fascinating to kind of see how he does against Leon Edwards. I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, it's been a long time since we've seen Leon. I mean, I think one of the questions with Kevin Holland is, you know, you know, he can fight 170, he can fight 185. Where does he see it? We've kind of seen him and Israel Adesanya going back and forth. But, I mean, obviously Kevin Holland is a guy to pay attention to as we head into 2021. But we'll mention coming up on Sunday's edition of the MMA Report podcast. Going to have three interviews. I told you about the chat that I had with Tyson Chardet. Also, last night, talked to Devontae Smith. He will be stepping back inside the octagon in February. This will be his first fight since August of 2019. Shortly after that fight, he suffered a torn Achilles injury, so had a great chance with him. Also, I talked to Sullivan Cawley, who won his pro debut last month in Bellator. He's a training partner of Ryan Bader. Had a great chat with him, talking about kind of what his career has been to that point. So that's going to be on Sunday's edition to the podcast. Hopefully everyone has a great Christmas weekend, holiday weekend. Bucks play on Saturday, so I'll be working on Saturday. Hopefully it's a celebration in the Floyd household on Saturday night, as we got a chance to clinch the playoffs on Saturday. And then Sunday, fun day for me, Daniel, where I get to sit around and just kind of enjoy the day. It doesn't happen very often for me during the football season, but I got a nice Sunday coming off for me.
Well, man, I hope you have a great Sunday, brother, and I hope you have a great Christmas. I hope everyone listening to this has a great holidays. You know, it's been a rough year. It'll be a rough 2021, brother, but I think halfway through, I think we'll be sailing good, man. I think by the summer, we'll be chilling. So I hope everyone has a good holidays, man. And I, for one, personally, when it comes to what I'm watching, I am hyped. I am so ready for this NBA season. I love the NBA. I've enjoyed the first 2 days, and there's something absolutely special about sitting down Christmas Day and just watching basketball, and a whole lot more basketball. So that is what I'll be doing. I hope at some point my favorite team, the Houston Rockets, plays a game. But at this point, that seems unlikely. I really want James to get his stuff in order.
Yeah, for people who did not see the end of that Celtics-Bucks game last night, man, that was an awesome ending of that game. I got to tell you a story before we get out of here. So, you know, I am a procrastinator when it comes to Christmas shopping. So yesterday, December 23rd, was the first time I went out Christmas shopping. Got it all cranked out like in 2 hours. But my last stop was to the liquor store. You know, because, you know, you go to the liquor store, they've got all the holiday packaging, whatnot. So went there and got a bottle for a buddy of mine and, you know, bought a couple bottles for my house here.
Yeah.
And, bro, I got the last parking spot in the building.
The liquor store?
Easier for me to park at Target than it was the liquor store.
Mm-hmm. That's hilarious. That everyone needs their liquor during this time. You know what's funny? Or not funny. This is actually not funny at all. But when it comes to like the spread of COVID-19, dude, I feel like more, like, you know how they say like don't congregate with your family or whatever? Dude, I feel like and you know, people listen to the health authorities, right? Do that. But I will say this. Dude, Target, HEB, where I'm from, that's a grocery store. All these places, this is the point I'm making, they are freaking packed. They are freaking packed like it's a normal day. There's no way the thing's not spreading, right? Whenever everyone's, because like when it comes to Christmas, I feel like the way this thing is going is just everyone's out and about, bro. I know everyone's wearing masks, but Jesus Christ, dude. Like, I went to Target the other day just to get a frozen meal. I mean, yeah, it's like people think, you know, it's like people think we're like magically protected when we go. But yeah, bro, I can imagine that that liquor store was packed.
Yeah, dude, it was crazy. I remember, like, you know, I'm walking around the store, you know, looking to see what kind of, you know, special, you know, holiday package they got. You know, the ones that, you know, it's a bottle plus it comes with, you know, some, you know, type of glassware in it. And, you know, so I get everything I'm getting and I'm like, where does the line start to hit the cashier?
Was there not a line, or was it too damn long?
Oh, it was too damn long, dude. And then,
dude,
like,
that's
okay. I'm in line. I'm getting towards close to register, and they've got little mark-offs of 6 feet. And so I'm standing on the one. The guy in front of me is standing on his, and this dude behind me had to be 2 feet from me. And like, I almost got that point. I want to look at him and go, "Hey, do you know what 6 feet is?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They really needed to have like an employee whose whole job is to be like, hey, 6 feet apart.
Oh, no, 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 no. You don't. That would be the worst job. You better get combat pay for that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because, man, if you do not follow Rex Chapman on Twitter, you got to, because he finds all these videos of basically maskless people going at it with store employees who are basically like, put on a mask on or get your ass out of here. And, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, that's like combat pay.
Yeah, maybe that could be a job for former UFC fighters.
Bro.
I mean, are you really going to tell, like Marcin Tybura, you're going to be like, no, I don't want to wear a mask? No. He's going to put you to sleep.
You got to make sure the guy's got cauliflower ears going on. So they really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like it's from Extreme Couture. I think that'd be great.
Yeah, dude, it was. I of all the stores I went to yesterday, I was like in and out of all of them. Liquor store, not so much. Something about our society.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I can't blame anyone, man. Enjoy your holidays.
I remember. Yeah. So this was, man. This had to be 6-7-ish years ago. It was Thanksgiving night. Me and my wife walk into this liquor store that's. The back of it's a bar, and the front of it is a liquor store. It was right across the street from the radio station that I work for. And, I mean, you talk about dive bar. I mean, bro, dive bar. Dive bar, dive bar. And I remember we're coming in, getting a bottle. We go to pay for it. And the guy looks at me and goes, ABC liquor closed, huh? I go, yep. He goes, yeah, you look too normal to be in here.
you weren't chain smoking that, with the motorcycle jacket.
No. Man, yeah, that's always the interesting thing on like a holiday night of trying to find the liquor store that's open.
Mm-hmm. Or just the restaurant that's open. I mean, you're going to have to go to a Chinese food place.
That is true. That is true. One of the restaurant properties I work for, we will be open on Christmas night. So, yeah.
Hell yeah.
But, yeah. Most restaurants, yeah, will be closed. Yeah. And it's, and obviously it's, there's a lot of new regulations going on here too. So, that is definitely part of it, but, that is going to do it for this edition of the MMA Report podcast. Of course, be sure to give Daniel a follow on Twitter. He is at Daniel Galvan DGG. Of course, I am at Jason_Floyd. Of course, be sure if you have not given us a rating and review, especially if you're listening to Apple Podcasts, would appreciate if you would do that. Of course, the next episode of the podcast comes out on Sunday. That'll be the interview edition of the podcast. And myself and Dale will be back next week for the final podcast of 2020. We're going to have a great offer from HelloFresh. So be on the lookout for that coming up here next week here on the podcast. So that's going to do it for this edition of the MMA Report podcast, which you can always hear on RadioInfluence.com, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Podcasts.
This is a Landry Football Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
And I tell you that Auburn's, they want to go out and hire Kevin Stewart because I talked to the guys that are doing the hiring. Know what Kevin said. I know what Jimmy Rain says. I know what the athletic director at Auburn said because I talked to all of them personally. I know where they were headed. The fact that it switched is what I want to talk about. All the news that came out in this Auburn search, much like it did with the Tennessee search with Greg Schiano, it blew up. Now, Schiano's situation was done. They were going to hire him, and Twitter blew up, and they rescinded this. The Auburn situation didn't go down quite that far. It was, we're going to hire Steele, and that got out. How did it really get out that Steele was the guy? Alan Green, the athletic director, made sure that that got out because he wasn't comfortable with that, and he had no power. The power was with mainly Jimmy Rain, who was the key booster that wanted to ramrod Kevin Steele in. Again, I love Kevin Steele. I don't know that he was the right fit for Auburn. I just think it might have worked out for Kevin had he been there. I don't know. We'll never know because they went in a different direction. The point, we've rehashed that. I don't want to rehash it. We've hashed that, I should say. So as Alan Green lets that out, the public backlash made it so that even the key money-making booster, see, no one group of individuals are going to be able to have that type of power. But collectively, we are seeing a little bit of, we don't want that guy. That's not going to work. We don't support that. And the, trust me when I tell you, the PR backlash affected it. They may say it didn't. I'm telling you it did.
The Landry Football Podcast with veteran scout and coach Chris Landry can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.